thing was just the background of excitement about the internet as a forum and as a kind of catalyst for political action. Mm-hmm. You know, so there were the supposed Twitter revolution in Iran and all of these things. And so it felt like it was where political hopes were being invested, that the internet was the place to go to think about political issues. It was before Occupy Wall Street burst on the scene, which was something I got really sucked into. So those two things, the sort of cultural realm and how that would affect me as a filmmaker and what that meant, and the political realm came together. And that's how I started looking at these issues and made my way towards writing the book. But the seed that actually got me writing, though, was that I went to one of these conferences about culture and the internet, and there were all these presentations, and they were very enthusiastic about social media and participatory culture and the power of things like Wikipedia, and there was this very real, palpable utopianism there. But then underneath everything was this total corporate speak. Mm-hmm. So people would talk about breaking down the barriers and letting amateurs have more of a voice. But then there was also this pressure to suddenly have advertising sponsored content be your mm-hmm. bread and butter. So that marriage of this kind of, break down the barriers, disruptive rhetoric with this intense commercialization was very interesting to me. And so I kind of left this conference. I went intending to be very inspired and left feeling like, okay, there's a darker side here that we need to explore.
And it seems almost, maybe we shouldn't be surprised, but this subtle in terms of the corporatism that we're lured into it under the myth of this freeing democratization of the internet age.
I think you're exactly right. We shouldn't be surprised. In a sense, it's surprising that I even had to write this book or felt compelled to write this book, because the basic argument is that you can't sidestep market forces with these new tools. Mm-hmm. And that if we want these new communicative technologies to live up to this sort of utopian promise, to these democratizing ideals, then we're actually going to have to rethink their economic underpinnings. But what was amazing to me was how those questions were just completely left out of the debate. Instead, the mainstream debate was asking things like, is the internet making us stupid? Are our phones addictive? Do video games help our cognition? And there were sort of these cognitive questions and also questions that emphasized the user's morality or lack thereof, or their self-control. And to me, the question is, well, why do we have addictive design? Because, well, that's because the companies that are creating these apps and gadgets want us to use them all the time because that's their business model. So I wanted to switch the emphasis from the relentless focus on the individual, which gets into this area of passing judgment on people, and go zoom out and look at the structural forces. So take it, and I felt like the conversation was very much focused in the wrong direction.
It seems as if the conversation, there was a moralism in the conversation, which passed over what were more substantive issues that we need to address.
Yeah, the focus on the individual users. You know, are you strong enough to not be addicted to your gadget and to have disconnected time? You know, or are you distracted by, you know, reading all of these little nuggets instead of engaging in sustained reflection? And there were people, you know, very emphatically making both points. So there were sort of the utopians who were like, everything we do online is there's a book called Everything Bad is Good for You, that we're actually becoming these very astute multitaskers, and we're mm-hmm. going to be smarter and better than ever. There's actually a book called Smarter Than You Think that's yes. about these tools. And there was The Shallows or You Are Not a Gadget. So there are these very strong pros and cons. And I wanted to say, hold on, let's take a different tack here and focus on the economic and social and political context that technology is operating in, so that we can put, actually, instead of this moralizing, we can actually put issues of inequality and justice into the conversation, really. So that's what I was trying to do with that book. And what that really means is actually just going back to the media criticism that progressives have always had and offered. I felt like that tradition, mm-hmm. which you can see in, you know, some of my heroes, like the Frankfurt School, or in the work of people like Noam Chomsky or Robert McChesney,
yes.
since those are people your listeners would probably be familiar with it, that this whole tradition of media analysis was as though technology had made it irrelevant.
Yes.
And I'm just saying, no, it's actually pretty applicable.
That's good. Yes, indeed. You're listening to More Talk Radio. My name is Cecil Prescott. My guest today is Astra Taylor, who is the author of a forthcoming volume entitled The People's Platform, Taking Back Power and Culture in the Digital Age. I'm going to encourage you who are listening to give us a call at 503-231-8187, or you may email us at moretalkradio@gmail.com, and you may share your perspective on your thoughts on the digital age and whether or not technology is a worthwhile tool and how we might use it. I want to encourage you to, on the 15th, to get the book. But until then, continue to listen to Ms. Taylor as she shares some of her thoughts with us this morning. One of the things that you go into it in your book as you analyze the corporatism and almost the subtlety of corporatism. So many of us might have thought that sitting in front of our computer or screen and playing games and seeing which mythological character you are like is, not to be moralistic, and, I'm taking up some time, I should be, spending time with my spouse, but it's really no big deal. Maybe I'm not being a good spouse, but it's not much of a problem. You seem to think that, it may not be much of a problem, but something's happening when I'm playing these games on Facebook or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, it's tricky because each moment that we're online, and I do too, whether I'm frittering away the time or using it constructively or whatever. I mean, it's hard if we get caught up in those individual moments, I feel like we miss the forest for the trees. Yes. And the bigger issue is the fact that those games are connected to a larger business model of data mining and surveillance that none of us really chose. And I think it's quite interesting the way public skepticism has reached a sort of turning point, because when I started writing this book, there wasn't a lot of concern about these issues. There were in certain quarters, there were people who were sounding some alarms. But just I think it was last week there was a new poll that showed the majority of Americans think that internet companies are encroaching on too much of their lives. So people get the fact that even if they depend on and enjoy these services, whether it's Facebook and the games you're talking about, or Google and its search engine, that there's still something wrong, that there's mm-hmm. something to be alarmed by. And I think that we can like our toys and still be critical of them. Mm-hmm. There's not the idea of just quitting it all and not using phones or email providers or social media isn't the path I'm advocating at all. It's an awareness of the way things are going and thinking about alternatives.
So speak about what is going. Who's profiting off of those of us who sit in front of our computer who are playing these games? It seems at least at one point, I think in your book where you talk about, I can't find my notes, but you talk about we believe that, the ideas are free, we're just all in here together, and that no one's actually making money, or how do you make money? Am I making myself clear to a degree?
Yeah, I think the issue of who is profiting. Well, right now there are these enormous tech titans that are arguably becoming monopolies, or there's very little competition. And these are companies that not that long ago were considered upstarts. I mean, if you look at the sort of tech criticism from 2005, 2006, presented very much as David versus Goliath, and David was Google and YouTube and all of these digital companies, and Goliath was the old school media, and it was Hollywood, and it was the record labels, and now it's very much Goliath versus Goliath, right? Mm-hmm. And more than that, those giants are merging and collaborating in ways because. In some sense, they have common interests. You know, companies are online companies like Amazon and Google are getting into content creation. Mm-hmm. In other words, they're not just providing means of discovery. So, you know, they make the gadget, they provide the operating system, and they also make original videos and games for us to consume. So in an amazingly short span of time, it's become very clear who profits. These are now some of the biggest companies on Earth. I mean, Apple is constantly jockeying for the position of the number one company on the planet. And that's not to say that we don't benefit in all sorts of ways. Mm-hmm. Having just been on the road with the band traveling for the last few months, I've certainly benefited from my ability to see where I am using GPS and to find cafes that I'd like to go to. I mean, there, you know, we can count our blessings at the same time that we can be critical of the bigger system and the way things are heading.
We're speaking this morning with Astrid Taylor, author of the forthcoming book, The People's Platform, Taking Back Power and Culture in the Digital Age. I want to encourage you to give us a call with your thoughts, 503-231-8187, or email us at moretalkradio@gmail.com. One of the things you mentioned as we began our conversation, I'm not sure whether when we're on the air or off the air, but in terms of your participation in the Occupy movement, and there was that thought that this was a new period in social organizing. You mentioned earlier about the Twitter revolution in the Middle East, and this might be tools in which people might be able to organize their communities. There's that promise, mm-hmm. that people are connected more than they have been in the past. Do you think we have understand the power of those tools? What are some things we ought to be aware of as we go down this path?
Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, even the way the discourse around these supposedly protest enhancing technologies has changed is really fascinating, because at first it was just a sort of ecstatic watching the Arab Spring, and there were all these news reports, right, of an Egyptian couple who named their child Facebook because they were crediting these Silicon Valley companies with the upheaval. And there's no doubt that the ability for people to communicate easily with a wide group of people, you know, makes things possible, especially when you're operating in a context where there's an oppressive regime and communication is normally suppressed. I mean, I have a lot of thoughts about this that are fairly muddled, only because in my work that has come out of Occupy, I was part of an offshoot of Occupy Wall Street called Strike Debt, and we did this debt abolishing campaign called the Rolling Jubilee, and we're now thinking about how to actually build debtors unions or debt collectives or some sort of institution that would be more long-lasting. So these are, you're asking questions I don't have clear answers to, because I'm so engaged with, I'm so deeply struggling with them, to be honest. But I do think the framework that we initially understood these tools through, which is the framework of the Arab Spring, was a little bit misleading, because that's not the context of the United States. So looking at the way those tools transformed people's ability to mobilize, there is, it's a very different dynamic than what it means in a sort of tolerant, liberal, hyper-capitalist society. What mm-hmm. is, you know, here we're invited to communicate and express ourselves all the time. So it's not as subversive for us to weigh our opinions and I mean, defy. I mean, there's something else that we have to do besides communicate. We have mm-hmm. to somehow figure out how to build power and challenge power mm-hmm. in an American context. And I think one thing Occupy showed is we're not quite sure how to do that. These tools were very good for getting people out into the streets and not for getting people out in the streets, but for broadcasting the fact they were in the streets mm-hmm. and for creating a kind of spectacle that people could tune in. But it's not, they don't necessarily help you after the spectacle. That requires a different kind of commitment and connection and a type of organizing that people have, a type of organizing skills that these skills just haven't been passed down. So I think it's that's where I think a lot of the challenges and problems are. So these are great. It's great to be able to give an update about the Rolling Jubilee to the 15,000 people who follow us on Twitter. But it takes a lot more than an update to organize them and get them to do something that would meaningfully challenge the current economic reality. Mm-hmm. And it's really nice. Sometimes you can get them to, you know, donate money or sign a petition. And I think those things are actually all psychically valuable. I think for people to feel that sense of, okay, I've signed this. I'm now a part of this thing. I'm invested. Well, I'm not denigrating that. I think that you know, some people dismisses collectivism, and I think no, it's actually a valuable aspect. It's just we have to go further, and we have to have other things for people to do
yes.
besides just sign their name, and that it's really a challenge. So, but I to get back to my first point, I think the framework of this analogy that somehow, you know, social media in the Middle East is the same as social media here, that mm-hmm. because there's a kind of liberatory potential in that context that it applies in the American context. I think power operates in a really different way mm-hmm. here. Again, mm-hmm. this is not an oppressive authoritarian regime where silence is imposed on us. This is a culture of constant expression and say what you want and companies co-opting, you know, revolutionary rhetoric and messages. So it's just a different world, and we have to figure out how to organize in that world.
Indeed. Let's go to a caller. Jack, good morning.
Yeah, good morning. Interesting conversation. Your references to gaming and stuff, frankly, I can't even relate. I've never played a game online in my life. Never even played a video game in a bar or a pub, but come from that era where and I'm in the creative arts and in the musical world, and used to score with pen and ink and pencil and created things on typewriters with whiteout and all of that coming up, and the great tool that you can get so much done with a computer these days. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. I think that there's a lot to be gained by reflecting on your work as you go along. That it can be created so quickly is sometimes maybe something of an illusion. But we do have to work so much, and I appreciate you are a filmmaker, a writer, and you obviously have to dedicate a lot of time to your work, your focused work. And it always comes down to me, and I came kicking and screaming to Facebook, actually, because it's almost essential to do for promotion if you're in the performing arts and you got to get the word out about what's going on, the promotional aspect of it, and just having a website and knowing how to update it and be on top of that isn't enough. You got to get the word out more. But I always come to, because I have a lot of friends who are in the creative arts too, and I always come down to one question when I see people sending me Facebook notices all the time, do this, and take a look and see how much they're there. And I think, how the heck do they have time to get any real work done? You know, it comes back to the same question I used to ask people when they say, oh, did you see this on TV? Did you see that on TV? Who has time to watch TV? How do you get any work done? So how do you deal with that issue?
Right, Jack.
Wow, there's a lot of little threads in that question. How do I deal with getting any work done? Oh, I don't. You have to fight the procrastinatory impulses.
Away from the social media long enough to get some real work done.
Yeah, it's true. For me, it's I actually will say I used a tool. One thing is writing this book. I had to stay very alert to the fire hose of tech news. It just felt like there was stuff coming at me through every social media stream, 24 hours a day. And there actually, there's a Read It Later app. I use one called Pocket. And what it does is it would let me, then I would just go online and I would say, okay, I'm just skimming. I'm basically just here grazing, looking for links, but later I'm going to turn off the Wi-Fi connection and really read everything I've saved. Mm-hmm. And so there are, you know, mechanisms like that really helped me. To your comment about TV, the fascinating thing though is that television viewership has not declined with the rise of the internet. It's just been added to. People are actually watching more TV than ever before. So that's another big myth that was promoted in all of these sort of Web 2.0 and booster pieces from, you know, 10 years ago, was that the internet would kill the television. And really what's happened is TV is thriving in this way nobody anticipated. So I find that kind of fascinating, that somehow we're just managing to compound and add more and more media. Mm-hmm. You know, now we can socially network while we're watching television. So I find that pretty fascinating.
That is amazing. A few years ago, when my provider, my ISP, was trying to get me to upgrade my cable service and stuff, and they said, "Oh, you got to have the TV, you got to have these channels." I said, "Look, you know, I don't even watch it anyway. Cut it completely. Just cut it. I don't even want it."
Yeah, but they often won't let you cut television. They bundle. I mean, this is one of the reasons these companies are so loathed, these cable providers, because they essentially have there's no competition. They agree not to compete with each other. Mm-hmm. So most of us have really only one choice in terms of our cable broadband provider. And they force us to get both, the internet services we want and the whole cable package. So I'm in the same boat. I have channels coming into my house, but I have no television and don't want to watch them. Mm-hmm. But these companies are, you know, such a good example of this intensifying corporate power and these monopolies. And the thing is that they're just growing with this potential Time Warner Comcast merger on the horizon.
Yeah, right, and the question of the commercialization came up, and I don't know if you're aware, Cecil, but every time you log into a web-based email account, and your provider is throwing advertising at you left and right on both sides of the screen, every screen impression that's put up there, they're making some fraction of a cent or whatever on that, whether you look at it or not. And frankly, I mean, I won't use those services. I just get my email called down to my desktop client. You know, I detest every time I have to go to their website to do anything, and avoid it at all costs. And I don't know if other people have that attitude or not, but I really resent it that, you know, that they're making money off of forcing me to go, which I'm not forced to. I have a workaround, but that they're making so much money on just providing service to people, most people think it's the only way to use it.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're not alone, because so many people use ad blocker and these other services because they don't like seeing the advertisements as well. But I think there's a question that follows from that, which is that if advertising doesn't pay for these services that we're using, then what does? And I think as a society, we haven't wrestled with that, because the thing is, you do have to pay somehow, and right now we pay through advertising, which really means we're paying with money, because advertising is a $700 billion a year business, and more of that money is circulating through online channels. But ultimately, it's factored into the prices we pay for things. Mm-hmm. So it's a very inefficient way of covering the costs of these sites and the content that we're viewing and all of that. And it's also a very unaccountable kind of funding mechanism, because we don't get any say in how the money is spent and what it goes to support.
Do you use advertising to promote your films and books?
I've never, I think there was an ad for my film in the, I remember seeing one in N Plus One magazine. So, but maybe my publisher will do an online ad campaign. Hopefully. Will be very invasive.
locally, we've got things, for example, like, I'll just give you one example.
Okay, we need to go.
Uh-huh. Well,
continue.
You know, okay, fine.
No, continue. I didn't mean for you to hang up. I meant for you to finish your point.
Thank you for the good questions. I'm very grateful.
Oh, I'm sorry. So give us a call and call back and make your point. I didn't mean to stop you from speaking. Speaking of the internet and how we read and how we are involved in this, you write about the evolution of bloggers and their roles and what their influence in this new age that we're living in. How are bloggers influenced by or influence how we see the world in terms of I think there used to be a time when I thought of a blogger as a college student writing, you know, her thoughts about her professor and posting it. It has evolved from that to a degree.
Well, in different ways. On one hand, blogging has really been replaced with using social media. Mm-hmm. So I thought it was interesting that the last caller mentioned updating his website, but that he still has to go to Facebook. And one thing is the way that these huge services have actually kind of eroded what was a more vibrant and varied ecosystem of personal websites or blogging. And now, you know, people have kind of let their what were their more idiosyncratic individual spaces go unattended to while just adding a new status update. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, ultimately, you know, you're then investing in a service where, you know, they might shut it down or change something dramatically and you might lose everything you've created. So there's a kind of risk inherent in putting all of your eggs in the Facebook basket or something. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've seen this when these companies get rid of certain things like Google Reader or whatever, that suddenly, well, that's gone because it wasn't a profit center. So I think blogging has shifted in that way. The other thing is that there was a sort of raging debate that's really died down around bloggers versus journalists and professionals in the media versus these outsiders. And I think what we've seen is a lot of the bloggers became insiders. So they might be people who primarily work online, but they're people like Ezra Klein or Nate Silver, who are now a sort of new media elite, and they have their blogger bona fides, but they're very much part of the establishment now, and a lot of money and resources are flowing to them. So they've kind of been incorporated. So some of the old assumptions that, you know, bloggers were outsiders and therefore kind of righteous and untainted, I think has been also problematized because there's a lot of invisible payola moving around the blogosphere. People get sponsored to write posts about certain things and say certain things. But on the other hand, there have been tremendous breakthroughs from people writing online. So you can't, I think people, you know, it's been proven that your ability to tell a good story or an important story is not predicated on whether you're writing for print media or for the digital realm. But certainly it's gotten to a point where it's far less clear. That old rivalry just doesn't feel like it describes things anymore. We're in a sort of more mixed up hybrid territory. And so I think it is interesting that these last couple of weeks there have been a lot of discussions about these A-list bloggers who really control a lot, who have, you know, generate a lot of the traffic and really dominate that world, and how they're being, they're now starting these news organizations and attracting a lot of funding and resources, and basically how, you know, the new media landscape that's emerging looks a lot like the old.
Yeah.
You know, it's white guys wearing T-shirts instead of whatever old-fashioned reporters wore. I don't know. Button-downs.
Button-downs.
Yeah.
It's like Mad Men or
But otherwise, it's, you know, so there's a sort of replication of the old media model. And that's one recurring theme in the book, is just how new is the new world.
We're speaking with Astra Taylor, author of The People's Platform, Taking Back Power and Culture in the Digital Age. And maybe we should talk about your subtitle, how we do that. But let's go to our next caller. Gary? Harry, good morning.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you for this interesting conversation. The question I have for your guest is, talk about the other side of the coin, social media restrictions. I know a few people who have jobs that they're, one of their policies or what you put on the social media reflects our company, which means we can fire you. Any thought about social media restrictions and also the government restrictions using the Patriot Act, and so the government can do just about anything they want to without telling us?
Yeah, I think those are some good questions. I mean, you know, the question is who do they empower more? And so that's one question that I was wrestling throughout this project was, you know, in a way, these technologies actually amplify existing power arrangements. So they might let you engage, you know, with your community online through your social media platform. But what they also do is they let your employers watch you, and your employer has power over you. Or they let the insurance company collect your data and find out something about you that might raise your premium, or they let college administrators look at high school students' social profile and decide whether or not to let them into school. So I think you raise a really good point, and whether that should be allowed, I think, is something that people are challenging through lots of cases. We hear cases all the time of somebody who has been terminated because of photos that have been posted, and occasionally they fight back and win, and occasionally they lose. So I don't have much to add to your comment besides agreeing that it's something that's quite worrisome. And I think the NSA revelations have really been a huge public service. I'm incredibly impressed with the way that Laura Poitras and Glenn Greenwald have been able to keep this issue in the news for so long, considering what a short attention span we have as a society, and they've just managed to roll it out pretty brilliantly. And the story keeps getting more complicated and astounding. But I think it's really shown the way that corporate and government surveillance are interconnected and can't be separated. And the way that government surveillance piggybacks actually on a lot of these advertising networks, which again are the sort of lifeblood of the digital economy. So I think it just raises a lot of questions. And one question for me is, does government involvement have to be so sinister? Because there are other methods of state-financed media, like public radio and things like that, that are I think, a social good. And instead, it just seems like all we're getting is the bad side. All we're getting is the surveillance and the spying and the secrecy. And it's costing us a fortune collectively. And yet we're not getting any of the sort of public good aspects.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
That point that we're getting all the bad aspect and not the good aspect certainly goes against, I think, a popular stream in our culture thinking in terms of, and maybe this is has evolved over the past couple of generations in terms of government equals bad, and this sense of the good of a public service or the public square is something that is certainly not as dominant as might have been in past decades. So there's this libertarian stream that is right on the surface of our culture, which makes it more difficult, I think, for you to convince people with your argument about government as being used as good.
Right. I mean, there's a libertarian strain in our culture generally on this issue.
Mm-hmm.
And people are very skeptical of the government, especially young people, and for good reason. I mean, the government has let us down, and there's just relentless propaganda about how incompetent it is, and the more that public services are eroded, the more incompetent they become. So there's a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy there that's problematic. But a lot of people have pointed out that the libertarian strain is even more robust in Silicon Valley and in that community. I mean, a lot of the sort of main figures in that area are outspoken libertarians, Peter Thiel, who founded PayPal, is a real Ayn Randian. Even Jimmy Wales, who founded Wikipedia, I think named his children for some Rand characters. So that ideology is very much alive and active.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that outlook, the government is always a force of oppression. When Mark Zuckerberg calls Facebook a social utility,
mm-hmm.
it's interesting because there's a kind of appropriation of a public-spirited language, but he's saying a private corporation,
mm-hmm.
a publicly traded corporation should provide this utility.
Yes.
And so I think that's one thing that's quite interesting in this world is the way the language is quite confusing. So we talk about things being public or private, but it's just now a setting on a social media stream,
mm-hmm.
right? We talk about things being social, but we don't mean social services. We mean somehow that they're interactive or something
mm-hmm.
like that.
Mm-hmm.
And we talk about things being open. So we'll talk about Wikipedia and Google being open services, but or being public, but those terms don't have anything to do with the way that they're financed or their business model. So
mm-hmm.
even though Wikipedia was founded by a libertarian, it is a nonprofit. It is not advertising supported. Google is a private company, but somehow they're both public because they're both accessible to all of us. So I think kind of reclaiming that language and asking what is public media actually,
mm-hmm.
you know, what about, what does public media in a digital age mean? I mean, in the old, pre-internet age, you had limited spectrum for television and radio, and that kind of justified carving out a niche and saying, okay, this should be
public
mm-hmm. and this should be financed accordingly, and there should be a different model
mm-hmm.
operating here. And everyone from Rupert Murdoch to Google's legal counsels had basically said, well, no, there's unlimited space online.
Yes.
So that argument goes out the window. There's no need for a public alternative.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we have is we say that things are, we say, you know, Google Books is like a library, and we invoke this public institution, but it's not a library. It's an advertising-financed repository that is basically a source of data collection, which the library isn't, it's interesting how our language, we actually are using public-spirited language, but we've evacuated it of meaning and significance.
Thank you for sharing that. I think that's a very important point, because as you spoke, I thought of how we think of public, and even institutions that we once were thought of as public institutions, public radio, public television, the bulk of their finances are corporations now, yeah. And not from the
demos.
National.
Yeah. And that's been a shift that, again, also has had this effect of eroding them,
mm-hmm.
and making them seem less, to have less integrity. Nonetheless, though, Americans are actually very content with their public media spending. I mean, the fractions of a cent that we each contribute.
Yeah.
You know, it's not actually in public media gets very high ratings in terms of trust.
Mm-hmm.
So it, contrary to the myth, actually, it's something Americans like,
mm-hmm.
Which is amazing because we have such paltry public media options compared to other countries. So it's fascinating that people are still so devoted. I think there's something in that. I just wanted to expose that strange double standard whereby mm-hmm. we're using this language, and the analogy that people feel compelled to invoke is the analogy of a library. This, you know, but these things are not libraries. But if we mm-hmm. want libraries, we could make them,
mm-hmm.
you know. So it's kind of like if you want the hype, you're going to have to change the business model.
So how do we do that? How do we take back a culture in this digital age?
Organize, and that's the challenge. I mean, I think that's why I became so captivated by the beautiful mess that was Occupy Wall Street, you know,
mm-hmm.
because somehow we have to organize ourselves and shift course. I mean, that amazing statistic that came out, maybe it was a couple months ago now, about 85 people controlling half the world's wealth. You know, that's the condition that we're operating in.
Yes.
And these new technologies are only amplifying that fact. I mean, when you have these multinational businesses based in Silicon Valley and they're used by people around the world, what it does is exactly just sucks money to Silicon Valley from other economies and other cultures. So there's this momentum that can seem really irreversible. But I think, you know, people have always organized politically against tremendous odds, and odds that actually seemed way worse, I think, than they do now. So, yeah, people, but, you know, the organizing has to come after the thinking through.
Yes.
And having a better grasp of what it is that is wrong. So I think with this book, I just wanted, you know, to show that the old problems of the old media world of consolidation, centralization, commercialization are still with us,
mm-hmm.
and that despite all of the idealism around these new technologies and despite the sort of Silicon Valley rhetoric of openness and participation, that the web is still very hierarchical, and it's hierarchical in regards to its structure, the way the network is actually organized, which has which creates these network effects, which means, you know, everybody uses one search engine or people mostly use one social media company. So a hierarchy in terms of structure, a hierarchy in terms of economics, that mm-hmm. money then flows to these dominant centers, and social, that basically, if you look at the media landscape, that it's white men with money who dominate. They dominate at the technology companies, and they dominate in the new media startups that are out there. So I just wanted to show that these hierarchies are still with us, and so clarifying our thinking
mm-hmm.
Without being curmudgeonly, hopefully,
mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
is for me an important aspect. And I think I had to do that for myself, because it's my personality to overanalyze whatever it is I'm engaging with. And like everyone else on Earth, I was on the internet all day long. And so I wanted to know, what is this? What is this thing I'm participating in? How does it work?
We're speaking with Astra Taylor, author of The People's Platform, Taking Back Power and Culture in the Digital Age. It will be published in a week.
Oh, dear.
And the publisher is Metropolitan Books. How did you How did you sell them the idea of this book, this project?
I have to say I've always been a fan of Metropolitan Book. And they books, they actually are part of a big corporate publisher. And I did my last book with the New Press, which is a nonprofit. And I did a book, I co-edited a book about Occupy with Verso, which is an independent press. But Metropolitan is a special place. They published people like Barbara Ehrenreich, Susan Faludi, Tom Frank, and books that were influential to me when I was younger. And so there was actually a certain voice and a certain type of analysis. And so, this book to me was always a Metropolitan book. And they thought so too, so that was really lucky. But, you know, there are certain publishers that I'm loyal to, and they're definitely one of them. Just in terms of wanting to write something that was about ideas and politics and a book that wasn't afraid to talk about the logic of capitalism, but then also wasn't a sort of dry academic tome. So that's the kind of thing they do.
Well, this book is not a dry academic tome, so I appreciate that.
I like dry academic tomes. I just didn't have it in me to write one.
Well, yeah, I know. I'm somewhat familiar with some of your work, and Cornel West was actually one of my professors in school, and so I like those type of dry academic tone. But it's also good sometimes to read a book with which analyzed a situation, but it's also accessible, and this is what this volume is.
So. Cool. I'm happy to hear that. That makes me feel really good.
So, are you going to go on a grand book tour? And
I don't think so. I think I'm too shy to go on a book tour and do readings. But I am hoping to find a way to talk to people about it. I think doing things like this is nice, and I'll write some pieces and maybe do some organizing. There are networks being formed around a lot of the issues that I talk about in this book, from labor issues and the lack of labor protections online to, you know, all the work that's being done around net neutrality. So I think I might see where the book takes me in terms of joining those efforts
as an organizing tool.
And thinking about the you know, every project leads to the next one. So in this book, I wrestled a lot with the concept of cultural democracy. What does it mean to say something's democratizing? And so I'm thinking that might contain the seed of a future film project.
Excellent.
We'll see.
Excellent. As you think about the future, apparently you're not going to cancel your Facebook account or stop your subscription to your internet provider, and you don't want us to either. That we can use it, we can work with.
I think the thing is that there's often this reaction that if you're criticizing something, then you have to be pure and not engage with it. And so I think that's very unrealistic, especially for younger people whose employment prospects and futures depend on them participating in this realm. Because, you know, it's a myth that we are all choosing to do it in the sense that there's an obligatory aspect to social media, depending on where you're at in life, you know, where... if you're not on there presenting yourself in a certain way, it's as though you don't exist. You might be considered less trustworthy by potential employers or by people you're trying to rent an apartment through Airbnb from or something. There's a way that it's not simply that we are just addicts who can't help but reveal everything about ourselves, right? Mm-hmm. So I think it's possible to use these services and have a critical sensibility at the same time. And I don't think that's hypocritical at all. It's not about being pure and being offline and disconnected.
Okay. Let's see if we can get this one last caller before the end. JB, thank you.
Thank you. Congratulations. You're really doing, you're brave. You're extremely brave. What is the name of your book?
It's The People's Platform.
Yeah, we need that out there. I remember the day when this was a wonderful country and you could go out there and have a nice job and work hard, and I was always a union man and unions, and I got good pay so that I could have a home, a little home, and a little I have a car. Now they want to take my car away because, and I'm only in my 60s. And I've been discriminated a lot because I have felt that, and I don't want to talk about me, but I want to talk about people like you and the great things that people like you are doing to counteract this incredible Patriot Act concept where conglomerates own all of our big corporations and they live elsewhere, they're based elsewhere, and they have the power of the people behind them, mm-hmm. supposedly, or the Supreme Court says they are in charge.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, right behind me, they're filling up the armory with all kinds of equipment. Thank you for calling on that, by the way, Par. And that's important to keep up with this, because an older person like myself, my brain works good, but it's hard for me to have mobility in a wheelchair. So I try to do the best I can. I'm a good person. We are good people, all of us, whether at cable or not.
Hey, thank you, JP.
Thank you.
You bring up the point of being a union man, and I think that's, you know, one aspect that cannot be emphasized enough is how the decline of the labor movement has so contributed to the rising inequality that I think is the, you know, backdrop, overwhelming backdrop to this book. And we do need to figure out new forms of collective power building. I don't get into it in the book, but there are some really troubling areas of online employment. Even calling employment is a bit of an overstatement, because basically people work through programs like Amazon Mechanical Turk, where they do piecework online, but they're not recognized as employees, and they end up toiling for less than minimum wage with no labor protections. So we really need to bring back some of the old ideas like union organizing into the new economy.
I like that. Hey, thank you so much. We've been speaking with Astra Taylor, author of The People's Platform, Taking Back Power and Culture in the Digital Age, published by Metropolitan Books. And if you have a ticket, you can go see her band this evening at Crystal Ballroom.
Yep.
Okay. Thank you. This is More Talk Radio. I'm Cecil Prescott. Stay tuned for more talk and news on your community radio station, KBOO FM.
Have it tuned to KBOO in Portland, and it is coming up on 9 a.m. when we will be hearing from the Old Mole Variety Hour. Stay tuned at 10 for Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15 on Locus Focus, host Barbara Bernstein speaks with Eric Dinnerstein, author of The Kingdom of Rarities, which takes us to some of the least traveled places on the planet to catch a glimpse of the rarest animals in the world. At 11 on Health Watch, host David Naimans interviews local naturopathic physician and acupuncturist Dr. Gary Weiner about how to decipher what your spring allergies may be telling you about your health. And at 11:30 on Madness Radio, Dr. David Healy, psychiatrist, whistleblower, and author of 20 books, discusses industry corruption of pharmaceutical regulation and proposes better ways to protect patients and prevent harm. Thanks, KBOO members, for your support. If you're not a current member, check out kboo.fm and click on Donate Today. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Merrill Hurst University's first part-time MBA programs, 5 part-time MBA programs, each designed to provide an educational experience and a transformational journey for those who want to move business forward to change the world around them. Enrolling now for the summer term. Details at merrillhurst.edu. And also, this program has been made possible by a grant from the Clinton Street Theater, featuring independent and revival films, The Rocky Horror Picture Show, every Saturday at midnight, as well as the monthly KBOO Movie Night. The Clinton Street Theater is located at the corner of Southeast Clinton and 26th in Portland. Schedule and information at 503-238-5588 or cstpdx.com.
This machine stinks.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour here on KBOO 90.7 FM here in Portland, your community-owned and operated radio station. The mole is the beast that digs down to the roots of the world we live in, the world so far dominated and governed by upper classes whose enormous wealth is ripped off from the labor and lives of the vast majority. The mole brings you news of what happens underground. Not only the obscured workings of an exploitative system, but the work of everyday moles working in social movements and everyday life to challenge and eventually overturn the system that maintains our servitude, our poverty, and forms of production that threaten the very earth itself. I'm Clayton Morgridge. Kate Welch is our engineer today. On today's Old Mole, we'll be hearing about the significance of the latest report on climate from the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC, and what can be done about the dangers to human life and to the planet that the report foresees. We will also hear commentaries about why capitalism must always produce inequality, never equality, and about the illusion that a middle-class life of affluence is something we can and should aspire to. And for an illustration of a way of life worth our aspiration, we will listen back to our Movie Moles discussion of a film about community gardening. And we'll hear some great music along the way, so stay tuned. If you want to hear today's show or any recent show again, you can check us out at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour, where in a day or two you'll find today's show ready for replay, either as a whole or in its individual parts. You can also keep up with us by becoming our friend on Facebook. Well, first up today, Bill Resnick talks with political economist Robin Hanel about the dire predictions from the group of scientists charged with keeping us up to date on the threats to our lives and the planet from climate change. Here's Bill.
Robin Hanel, welcome to KBOO.
Good to be with you again, Bill.
Robin Hanel taught economics for many years at American University in Washington, D.C. He wrote extensively on alternatives to capitalism, including the book Of the People, By the People, The Case for a Participatory Economy. Since relocating to Portland, he has devoted himself to environmental struggles, particularly around climate change, and he wrote the book Green Economics, Confronting the Ecological Crisis. Robin Hanel, last week, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change released their most sober and grim report. Tell us about it and give us your sense of what needs to be done to prevent absolute catastrophe.
Well, the report has gotten a lot of play in the media, as it should. This focuses on estimating how damaging is this climate change going to be. The scientists are now writing in a language that ordinary people can understand. And I think that's part of the reason that it has gotten more media attention. Hey, they've been telling us this every time, But this time they've said it in a way that's easier for us to hear, that what they're saying is we are on a trajectory that is completely and totally disastrous and unacceptable. And we can tell you that in great detail and with a great deal of certitude. People also need to remember that these are consensus reports, and there are thousands of people who are signing off on this. So nothing can actually be said that there really isn't complete and total consensus around amongst all these experts. So they are these are disastrous predictions, but they are actually conservative and cautious disastrous predictions about what's going to happen if we don't act.
Give us just a brief sense of what the predictions are.
As an economist, I think of it this way. If you read this latest report and you calculate just in dollars and cents term, the loss that's not loss of human life, but loss that you can put a dollar value on. If you add it all up, what they're saying is that that amount is absolutely sort of unthinkable. And yet what we know would be required in order to eliminate the risk of having that incredible financial loss on a global scale, pennies, 1 to 1.5% of GDP over a period of time. What they are telling us is that we need to buy an incredibly cheap insurance policy where the insurance premiums are very, very low, and what we are guaranteeing ourselves is we are avoiding something that is absolutely a catastrophe that nobody should be able, that nobody should think of themselves as being able to afford.
Including billions of lives lost. And
that's not even talking about the human loss. These scientists and experts have been telling us in their way for quite a while now that we're doing something that makes absolutely no sense, that we are on track to create the greatest disaster in human history. And I think this time they are now telling us in a way that's easier for people to hear.
Yeah, including, in fact, possibilities of human extinction, it seems to me, in a variety of different ways. But one of them would be because of wars that would result from the destruction of many countries, mass deaths in many countries.
We are at risk of creating a situation which makes life on the planet unlivable to any civilized person.
This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole, talking to Robin Hanel about the coming climate disaster and what can be done about it. Robin, we've gone through some of the grim consequences.